You're listening to a Diplomacist podcast. Hello and welcome to the Global Podcast. We're here with the Experts Desk. We're joined, as always, by our three scholars of world affairs, politics, and economics here at McGill University in Montreal. They are Jessica Leiber, Leila Mati, and Patrick O'Donnell. This is our special post-election special, and we will be analyzing the shocking outcome of the U.S. presidential election. Donald Trump, a man with no political or military experience, will become the 45th president of the United States in January. So, let's get right down to it. We start with an article in the Washington Post. It is ominously titled, "Trump Voters Will Not Like What Comes Next." In this article, Garrison Keillor says, literally, I'm quoting here, "feh" to the idea that the white working class chose a candidate that they thought would fight for their interests. He says, quote, "We liberal elitists are now completely in the clear. The government is in Republican hands. Let them deal with him. Democrats can spend 4 years raising heirloom tomatoes, meditating, breeding Jane Austen, traveling around the country, tasting artisan beers, and let the Republicans build the wall and carry on the trade war with China and deport the undocumented and deal with opioids. We Democrats can go for a long, brisk walk and smell the roses." So, let's get right into it then. Is Keillor right? Have Trump voters been led into an abyss that they will feel the brunt of the pain from? And are Democrats right to wander away and let the Republicans deal with the fallout? Let's start with Patrick.
Thanks, Benson. I think this we're obviously going to have to answer it in two parts. And I think the first part is who will feel the brunt of a Trump presidency. And in this sense, I do think Kyler's right. I think for the most part, it is in fact people who are angry, not without reason, in fact, at what they perceive to be the liberal elite or the political elite. Who have now voted Trump into power, who are going to feel the major impact of a Trump presidency. We've already seen moves, Rudy Giuliani being considered for attorney general. I'm seeing eye rolls around the room. Trump saying he's going to dismantle the EPA. I mean, who is this going to affect, right? Poor rural communities. And regardless of what motivated this vote, they are going to feel that impact. As to the second part, can the liberal democratic sort of elite just sit this out for the next 4 years at least? Fundamentally, that seems like a democratic mistake, like a flaw in democracy. It's when you lose an election as a politician, unless you didn't believe what you were saying, you have a responsibility to fight the other side, right?
Yeah, I think I would have to agree to an extent with your first part of the answer. I think that some of the people who are going to feel it the most truly are minorities, and they're already feeling it now, before he's even been sworn into power. So for that part of the question, I think that those people are going to suffer much more. And like connecting that to the second part of the question is that I think that Democrats absolutely have a responsibility to keep fighting, especially for those people who are going to feel it the most. I think I'd agree with you, but only to an extent.
And if we do agree that Trump is not going to actually serve the white working class Americans that he has promised so much to, such great grandiose outcomes, the Democrats need to be there and rebuild their party, rethink their movement, so that they are able to provide an alternative, especially when the midterm elections come up in 2 years, because that is really not that much time for them to sort of redirect themselves.
I'd also be curious to see how much Trump is actually going to get done that he promised to these people that voted for him. He's already starting to turn back on some of the promises that he made. He's already starting to walk away from, you know, some of the rhetoric that he used in his campaign. So specifically, I remember reading something this week about him saying that he was okay with a same-sex marriage law, which is something that he's been preaching against for such a long time.
Well, I agree that was definitely a backflip on his part, but I think that part of that was also he came in and had advisors tell him, look, there's really nothing that you can do on that. You
know, exactly, things is that going to happen with, is my point. I'd be curious to see how much he actually manages to get done, and also I'm aware that there is some Republicans in Congress who aren't necessarily going to be behind him at all times. And yes, right now we have a Republican House and Senate and President, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be able to, you know, deliver on all these horrible, horrible promises.
And let's not forget, the Republicans may have a majority in the Senate, but it is tiny. They have one seat.
Exactly.
They have 51-48.
And how difficult is it to find one Republican who's not okay with everything that he says? Probably not very hard.
Exactly.
Certainly with a divisive president like President-elect Trump. I will just say one more thing, and that is that I think what we're seeing here is what the cost of our democracy is, right? When certain groups lose, in this case, when the Republicans win, we see the LGBT community suffer, We presume that Black Americans will suffer, that other racial minorities will suffer. We think that women will suffer. I will say, if we're speaking only to the white working class, I do think that this will hurt them incredibly seriously over his presidency. But in the long run, what we've seen is Democrats now, whether or not they like it and whether or not they feel that they are obligated morally to do so, have to start pandering to the white working class. In the long run, this might help them, and that's even scarier.
Next, we have a daring assertion in The Independent, but one that has nevertheless been corroborated over the past few days by a couple of other political commentators. It declares that Donald Trump would have lost the U.S. election had Bernie Sanders been the Democratic nominee. Now, that's a pretty bold statement, and it's one that I'm sure will be met with some sharply different opinions across this panel. So let's start with Layla.
I think, first of all, it's important to, you know, that saying, hindsight is 20/20. So, you know, what's done is done at this point, so wondering about what could have been with Sanders isn't exactly useful in moving forward. But to answer that question, I would say that I'm truly not sure, because she did win a lot more votes in the primaries. Even if you set aside how she had, you know, the DNC behind her, like, I do think that she had way more votes. Actually, it's a fact. She had 3.7 million more votes. She did better with moderates than Sanders did, and she actually didn't lose as much from, like, votes from liberals. So, you know, people who were saying that Bernie Sanders was doing much better with liberals, actually they were doing just about as well as each other. She won more African-American votes, was doing better with Democrats, and actually people with the more education voted more, leaned more towards Clinton than towards Sanders. So I think that the numbers don't really lie. If people had wanted Bernie Sanders as their candidate in the primaries, and if he had overwhelmingly won, it would have happened, I think. So I'm skeptical of that view, and I've been reading a lot about it, but I just truly think that, first of all, it's not really useful to be talking about this, and secondly, I don't really see the logic behind it.
And I'll also just add my quick point. I published my personal postmortem of the election this morning, and in it, one of the things that I discussed was, you know, if you look at the numbers, yes, Sanders performed much stronger in the upper Midwest. So those states that everyone was surprised when they went to Donald Trump, states like Wisconsin, Michigan, I don't really include Pennsylvania in the upper Midwest. I think of it as a mid-Atlantic state, but some include it in that group of states. But he performed better than her, certainly in Wisconsin and in Michigan. So it's possible that had Sanders been the nominee, he could have pulled off wins in those two states. But I remain very skeptical that he could have won in a couple of other states that Clinton did carry. Notably, Virginia, mm-hmm. which is a relatively relatively moderate, you know, conservative state that up until very recently was a Republican stronghold, but now it looks like could be a Democratic, safe state. You know, seeing as Clinton lost the presidency but won the state of Virginia.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that.
I would be very hesitant, though, to trust those numbers, because everyone had trusted previous polls saying Hillary Clinton would overwhelmingly win the election. So, I think this election, if not the Brexit vote and other elections that have taken place previously, I think polling has been called into question. So to use that to sort of make this analysis is ultimately flawed in and of itself. I would also make another point that we have to decide why Hillary Clinton lost. Do we think it was because Trump was able to paint her as a corrupt person, someone who caters to elitist? Those type of attacks could not have been made on Bernie Sanders. So if that was actually what ended up swaying the election in Trump's favor, Bernie Sanders might have been able to pull it off, but I totally agree with you that this is not a constructive conversation to be having.
One constructive conversation to be having is one that you just pointed out right there, is that can we really trust opinion polls? You know, I was having a couple of discussions about this last week. You know, most opinion polls are conducted through landlines, which is something that fewer and fewer people use, and the ones that do not necessarily represent a segment of the population that is representative of the broader electorate as a whole. And, you know, this is not the first time that we've seen it. It's the first time that we've seen such a strong failure of opinion polls in U.S. elections, but we've seen it for the past three major voting events in the United Kingdom. We've seen it across countless provincial elections in this country.
I will say, in terms of, I think, as probably the only Bernie Sanders supporter in the primary, I believe, in this room, seeing nods here, I actually have to agree with you guys. I don't think it's a productive conversation to be having, but what I will say, and what, I don't know if I want to say it's hardened me or saddened me, but what I've seen, and this is something that I've been saying since the primaries, is I don't think that if we assume and if we subscribe to the idea of democracy as we have it. We should not be pressuring people with convicted third-party votes or convicted third-party leanings to be voting for another party because they're the majority. I think that's what we've seen. The entire argument has been third-party voters have wasted their votes, and they have caused Trump's rise by not voting for the Democratic Party. And I think what we're seeing is, partially, a rejection of that model as well, that this centrist left kind of model to which fringe voters will have to subscribe simply isn't working, right? I don't think the Democrats took seriously the risk of losing those votes when, for example, they appointed Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who drew the left's ire to Hillary Clinton's campaign for very little advantage, right? I mean, what did she really bring other than the risk of alienating these voters? And I think we're going to see now that the left is going to have to be taken a little more seriously. And so I will say in that sense, I've been heartened. But in terms of would Bernie Sanders have won? Well, you know, maybe and maybe not. And I didn't think that was a productive discussion to be having when the argument was we should vote for Hillary because of this. And I don't think it's a productive discussion to be having now.
Now, of course, let's turn to the fallout that this election is having on the rest of the world, because U.S. elections are never just limited to the country's borders. And in Canada, federal conservative leadership candidate Kelly Leach was one of the country's first politicians to praise the new U.S. president-elect. She said that some of his policies should be emulated here. Her signature policy in the Tory leadership race, of course, is this idea that all new immigrants to Canada should be subjected to a values test that has been the subject of much derision from both within her party and beyond. She's now declaring that, like Trump, she is fighting elites. But as the National Post reminds us in a headline a few days ago, Kelly Leach is rallying elites while holding a $500 a person fundraiser organized by lawyers. Dr. Leach is, of course, also a well-paid member of parliament, a pediatric orthopedic surgeon with countless degrees. So is Dr. Leach really fighting for the little guy? And could this sort of Trumpian right populism make its way into conventional Canadian politics? Let's start here with Jessica.
Kelly Leach has placed herself in an interesting position over the course of the conservative leadership race thus far, and there does not seem to be an end in sight for her. I will first address your question to who Kelly Leach is fighting for in this race. To give her some degree of credit, she did not start from riches, but rather built her success from a modest background beginning in Fort McMurray, Alberta. And her success is owed very strongly to her work ethic. But I think her motives now have more to do with her and her resume than actual grassroots or anti-establishment voters, in air quotes. She is firmly entrenched in the political establishment here in Canada, so for her to run on any type of platform is unbelievably hypocritical. It is a reality that politicians need fundraisers in order to, you know, advance their own platforms, but she has criticized the Liberal government in Canada for holding the exact same cash for access fundraisers. Ultimately, it would be nice for Kelly Leach to actually take a stance on something and quit flip-flopping for her own gain. She seems to be praising Mr. Trump rather highly, while at the same time insisting she did not endorse him for president. She is a calculating political elitist, no doubt, making it all the more preposterous that she is running on this anti-establishment ticket.
Yeah, I will say, having watched the interview, I believe it was CBC, I could be wrong, where she was confronted, in fact, about this fundraiser and about her anti-establishment views, the, in my opinion, completely fair accusation that this does pander to elitism, she kind of consistently avoids this question by saying, well, I mean, there will all be people with elite education. But the question isn't elite education. It's who are you allowing to garner an audience with you, and that's people with money, regardless of the elite education. Sure, we're in a society where some people have education, others won't, and that's what keeps a society functioning, is having people who can perform all the roles of society. But that's not at issue here. And I think as we see her sort of come under more scrutiny as this race progresses, I think we're going to see that kind of come to the forefront. But I will also say what really concerns me about her proposals is that we have no idea what Canadian values are, because, I mean, there isn't a set, right? If you ask Pierre Elliott Trudeau, the West isn't really a region, barely, right? We're talking politics within a country that can't decide what the regions of the country are. I mean, Michael Chong himself resigned from Stephen Harper's from Harper's cabinet. Now, not necessarily because he disagreed with it, but because Harper agreed to recognize Quebec as a distinct linguistic region, right? What are we going to be spraying for Canadian values, right? If you ask someone from Fort McMurray who's not Kelly Leach what their Canadian values are, I promise you, as someone from Alberta, they will differ from the most part of the population of Ontario or Vancouver. This is how we get into this kind of partisanship, separated mentality that we've seen the U.S. kind of progress into.
And I have another point to, before I throw back to you guys to make just on the subject of Kelly Leach. Now, the involvement of Canadian politicians in American presidential races is certainly nothing new. You know, not even within this particular race. I remember, you know, a couple of months ago, Nikki Ashton came under fire for going to North Dakota and campaigning for Bernie Sanders. And back in 2004, we had the whole Carolyn Parrish debacle when she called George W. Bush a moron and then appeared in that 22-minute segment and appeared to stab him like a voodoo doll. So this is not new, but given that it's Donald Trump and given that nothing really seems to be following convention in this current American political climate, was it really appropriate for Kelly Leach and, to a lesser extent, other members of the Federal Conservative Party to go about so openly embracing Donald Trump?
I'm going to speak to how she addressed this type of issue at the first and only conservative leadership debate that was held in Saskatoon earlier last week. And she was saying that her screening of immigrant tests hearkened to Donald Trump's policy, and it would put her in a common grounds position with him, making her the ultimate person to be able to handle U.S.-Canada relations. And I think that is a big jump to be making, that because you hold common issues on immigration with someone doesn't mean you are able to rebuild Canada-U.S. relations. Again, that also assumes that there's something to be fixed with them now that Donald Trump has been elected president.
And it also assumes that if she is to become conservative leader and to win the 2019 election, that Donald Trump will still be president then, because that is not a guarantee. He could very well be impeached for doing something wrong, or he could resign because this job is more difficult than he thought it would be. So I think it's a bit of a stretch for her to make that argument. I agree with that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with everything that's been said so far, and I just want to bring up how I think how interesting it is that this has been bringing up issues not only in Canada, which is like a direct neighbor, but in other Western countries like Germany and France. There are now more or less radical views that are being validated, and so now we see conservative parties in France, you know, people like Marine Le Pen and the
conservative, and her daughter who has directly reached out over Twitter to work with Trump's new chief strategist.
Yeah, so now I think we're seeing a lot of our of the values we took for granted in the Western world being questioned. So I just find that very interesting.
Well, so let's talk about this kind of internationalism though as well, because I think what's fundamentally at question there is the question of our kind of political norms, right? Which are important to our democracy and which are really mostly just symbolic, right? So the question of, you know, should Kelly Leach be and her fellow conservative leadership contestants, should they be sort of promoting Trump's position? Should they be interfering in American politics? I think for me personally, the answer is no without good reason, right? However, I do think in this case, and in Kelly Leach's defense, unfortunately, I do believe that, you know, a politician discussing policies of another politician, whether or not they've yet been elected, with which this politician agrees, I think that's fully appropriate and, in fact, part of politics, right?
Of course.
Now, maybe campaigning for that politician or advocating for them to win an election is a separate issue, certainly if you're already a seated politician, right?
Like the case with Nikki Ashton.
Yeah.
Exactly. However, I do think that this question now is where we have to ask, or start asking ourselves, because this is where we seem very split, actually, is which of these norms should our politicians be held to, and which of them should take a side seat to what's right. And that's problematic, because we have different views of what's right, which is why we're discussing this election, right?
Yeah.
If you believe, as many of us, and I think perhaps all of us in this room do, that Donald Trump is an existential threat to the U.S., regardless of your occupation, whether you're a politician, which of these norms can be broken, right? And what's the impact of our long-term democracy of that? And if we say no, politicians have certain political norms they have to follow, who suffers when we refuse to break those norms, right? Who pays the price of democracy? Because there's no one in this room.
Yeah.
Certainly true. And sticking with that vein, we have one more story from abroad in terms of the reaction to world leaders to Trump's shocking election victory. Now, most Western leaders issued relatively tersely worded boilerplate statements saying they hope their country's relationship with the U.S. could continue to remain strong. That's the message that we were getting from Theresa May, Justin Trudeau, Shinzo Abe, François Hollande, even Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, despite the fact that since Trump's election, the Mexican peso has lost over 25% of its value and Trump's policies will almost certainly ravage his country's economy. But as we see in the International New York Times, this is not so from Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel. Though she did congratulate Donald Trump on his election victory, she also issued a stern warning to the U.S. president-elect. Germany and America are connected by values of democracy, freedom, and respect for the law and dignity of man, independent of origin, skin color, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or political views, she said in a statement, adding, I offer the next president of the United States close cooperation on the basis of those values. Was this a step too far for Chancellor Merkel? Will this move mean that, what will this move mean for German-American relations? We'll kick off this last question with Layla.
I think my answer is going to be disappointingly short, and this is probably the liberal in me speaking, but no, I absolutely do not think she went too far. I think that she stepped up to the plate where a lot of politicians did not. And I just want to also quote like a second part of her speech where she did say, Britain and the United States have an enduring and special relationship based on the, we are and will remain strong and close partners on trade, security, and defense. I look forward to working with President-elect Donald Trump building on these ties to ensure the security and prosperity of our nations in the years ahead. So does that really sound like something that's threatening to the relationship between Germany and the United States? To me, absolutely not. Any educated and rational politician would see that, you know, as, see her as a politician who's ready to work with him, but it is a stern reminder of the values that the West has encouraged for so long. And I think that I'm very impressed with her, and I respect her a lot for doing this, for stepping up to the plate and, you know, using this as a reminder of what the West's values are and not to lose sight of those, or what the West's values have been or are technically seen as or have been seen as for a long time. And that opens a lot of discussion about what are the West values truly, because clearly we've uncovered a lot of people who don't share those values.
And building on that, so, you know, it's been this common refrain in the world of politics that the President of the United States, whoever his political, leading is, right or left, he implicitly, and I hate to not be able to say he or she, but we've only ever had men in the role, unfortunately, so he is in many ways the leader of that half of the Western political movement. You know, you saw this in particular in the last century where, you know, you had Clinton really coming into his own as the leader of this, you know, third way center leftism. You saw George H.W. Bush, as the leader of, you know, center, you know, neoliberalism, you know, in the world. Do we think that with this statement from Chancellor Merkel, we may start to see, because she, of course, is the leader of a conservative ruling coalition in Germany, do you think that we may start to see a shift where you see this sort of battle between who is really the leader of the worldwide, you know, conservative movement? You know, is it the German chancellor or is it Donald Trump? Because they definitely, while both conservatives, are presenting dramatically different visions of conservatism for their countries and for the world.
I do think that article harkens on that a little bit by saying that Angela Merkel is, you know, placing herself in a very hard position, exercising a lot of soft power for Germany. And not to say the U.S. government necessarily bullies other nations, but being the strongest and sort of the world hegemon at the current moment, they are the ones who do tend to have the final say, especially in defense and military combat. So I think Angela Merkel is trying to step into her own there. And especially now with Brexit, she will be the person being representative of the values of the EU, which are those Western values I think Layla was discussing earlier. I think it's a great thing for her to be saying that and showing that Germany will not be at the whim of President-elect Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, you know, there's obviously a bias on my end being a liberal, but I think irrespective of party affiliation or political ideology, elected representatives are elected on a certain mandate, on a certain will of the people, and that should be the first duty of the country. But provided that those values aren't thrown into chaos through cooperation with other nations, you know, prosperity through trade, through negotiation, through cooperation is the second priority of these leaders. And I think in this case, what we're seeing is Merkel just clearly articulating, I've been elected to represent certain values. And these come first. And as long as these aren't thrown into chaos by my cooperation with the United States of America, we'll continue to cooperate.
And that's a remarkable departure from, because Theresa May has come under a great deal of criticism in the United Kingdom for her very boilerplate statement saying that she will work with Donald Trump and that she looks forward to continuing to build the UK-US relationship. You know, because she does not really have a political mandate of her own. You know, nobody really voted her into power. She just kind of became prime minister by default, and she's come under a lot of pressure.
Well, let's talk about that too, right? I mean, this I understand the criticism. At the same time, the fact that America has elected a right-wing populist extremist as their president-elect, for the most part, shouldn't impact if we're being honest, a powerful nation like Britain's own domestic policy or even their own foreign policy. I don't see the election of Donald Trump as a direct obstacle, or at least as a necessary obstacle, to UK-US cooperation. And so I don't see this as an issue, despite my being significantly more on the left than Theresa May and certainly than Donald Trump.
I agree with what you have to say there. I do think it's interesting, though, that there is criticism for Theresa May for giving what, in my opinion, is a completely non-contentious statement. And I do think, being slightly center-right myself, I would say that this is sort of the liberal elitist that Donald Trump or other populist parties are trying to hearken to, saying you're trying to create controversy where there is no controversy. Don't read into something that isn't there. You know, Theresa May did not say, you know, she supports everything Donald Trump does. She just took a very straight line, probably to keep any contention, and that's what followed her anyways.
And it was probably the same, you know, flat statement that she would have released had Hillary Clinton won as well. You know, and there wouldn't have been any reaction whatsoever from, you know, from the opposite end of the British political spectrum as she released that had Hillary Clinton.
Well, and I mean, if we go back to talking about who's going to suffer the brunt of the impact of a Donald Trump presidency, right? In that sense, you know, Donald Trump has been elected. So from not even from Theresa May's standpoint, but from the standpoint of the head of state of from the political head of another nation, lack of cooperation hurts everyone in both countries. So provided it doesn't kind of cross the red line of Theresa May's values, of Britain values, I'm going to agree with Jessica here. I don't see why she'd have responsibility not to.
Well, there we go. I think that just about wraps up this conversation. Always excellent conversations, and this has certainly been a conversation that I don't think this time last week any of us were expecting to have, but there you go. Thank you all, as always, Jessica Liver, Layla Mateen, Patrick O'Donnell. I'm Benson Cook. Thank you so much for listening to The Experts Desk this week.